Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey everyone, Ben here. Just a quick note before we get to this week's excellent interview with GM Josh Friedel. Next week's episode will be either on time or delayed or missing entirely. I don't know. I'm going to be traveling for work. I'm going to be doing a decent amount of that summer, so I'll be tied up. But the excellent news is that Macaulay Peterson of the Full English Breakfast and of Chess Base, esteemed member of the chess media with excellent knowledge and connections in the chess world, has agreed to guest host Perpetual Chess, and he's working on some exciting guests. So I'm not exactly sure when it will come at this point, but that will be coming soon, and there'll be a bit more later in the summer. So it's exciting stuff, and I really appreciate that Macaulay is going to step up and provide you guys with some excellent content. So with that out of the way, speaking of excellent content, please enjoy this interview with Josh, and I will catch you guys soon enough. Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. So we've got another great guest this week, well-known American grandmaster. He does some chess writing, does some chess presenting for the St. Louis Chess Club, is known to give good chess lessons, and most of all, of course, is a chess player and grandmaster, Josh Friedel. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, what got me thinking of inviting you on the show? I've been, of course, aware of your great chess play and reputation in American circles for a long time, but you just launched this YouTube series called Autopsy, where you presented your first video last week, and I greatly enjoyed it and thought, hey, now would be a good time to ask Josh to come on the show. So could you tell us a little bit about the idea behind this series?
I appreciate that. Basically, there were lots of people doing streams and things like this, but to be honest, I didn't think me playing Blitz or doing something like that, it's everyone's doing it, and I don't play Blitz well online. It would be a disaster and probably embarrassing. So I wanted to kind of do something which I'm a little bit better at, which is actually like explaining stuff and, doing these videos. So I've done videos before, but I wanted something that was more readily available to kind of broaden my audience and that kind of thing. So this concept of autopsy is basically that, analyzing a game and taking apart every move and every detail is actually very useful, but it's also time-consuming and, it's something that not everyone has the patience to do. So what I'm focusing on is I'm going over, say, one game a week, but I'm focusing almost exclusively on where exactly was the game lost or where did things go wrong. So not just like, okay, what were the actual moves that were the mistakes, but the thought process, like what was the problem? Like in the one I did, my first one, there was one position where it was a Ronan playing black, and he played a very understandable move trying to trade bishops, but it just lost too much time. And then for the rest of the game, like he refused to, open up the game and try to get counterplay. He wanted to create no weaknesses, and it was more that the thought process itself was what led him to losing rather than, you know, any one mistake, I think. And just that kind of view on losses. And obviously, if I'm using elite games, they you know, have a better thought process than I do, but I can still usually find where they went wrong, and that's kind of what the focus is.
Yeah, no, and it's appealing for a player like at my level, for example, because one thing I struggle with in elite games is I kind of don't know why, you know, where someone went wrong. So I know that Aronian and Carlson, as you just conceded and as you mentioned in the YouTube video, obviously they're stronger than you, but you're a lot closer to being able to explain their thought process than I am, or than, you know, basically any of your viewers would be. So I really enjoyed it, and I think it's it's important for chess players. You know,
I think so too, and also just with computers, like, people can look at the computer and go, oh, bishop g5 takes c1 in this particular game was a mistake because it's now plus 0.5, right, or something like this. But that doesn't mean anything. That doesn't explain why he went wrong. It doesn't mean, like, because to me, bishop g5 was such an understandable move, and I understood immediately why he played it. But at the same time, when you look deeper in the position, you realize, wait, that was actually a bad thought process, and it led him to just a very difficult position against, you know, the world number one. So
yeah, exactly.
The guy who knows how to punish you at that level. It's so little, these little things that do it. But a lot of it's just, I think, with computers, like, people have a false impression of what it is actually like to play a game and what the mistakes are made and all of this. Like, I don't know. I'm hoping that taking it apart will at least shed some light on these mistakes and, like, how they happen. And honestly, even at every level, whether it's mine or yours or just beginners, a lot of the same problems actually come up and the same bad thought processes. So trying to take them apart, I think, could be useful for lots of levels.
Yeah, for sure. Like the idea in the video you showed of, like, Aronian needing to accept a structural weakness rather than just try to avoid it. Mm-hmm. But in any event, it's a series that I hope you stick with. And I also think the length is good. I mean, there's a lot of streaming. There's also a lot of sort of quick recaps of games where, you know, you might get one or two takeaways, or you might see a nice tactic or something like that. But you're not really going to be able to dig too deep into what went wrong, especially in an elite level game. So, yeah, I'm excited for it. Do you you mentioned in the video that you've got other ideas in mind for what to show. Do you have anything specifically cooked up yet, or is it going to...
What I'm going to do is I'll probably, for my next one, I'll show another elite game, probably from the same tournament. Just because it's going on now, people are watching that. It's something for people to sink their teeth into. I might do a game of my own where I know what I was thinking during the game, so I can go a little bit deeper and show my many errors in thought, essentially. But I can do it from a personal standpoint. So, you know, when people themselves are trying to go over their own games, they can use that as a template, sort of. And at some point, I'm hoping if it really becomes popular and people like it, I can have people send suggestions for games or even their own games at some point, and maybe pick one per week to go over. And that could be an interesting way to continue the series.
Excellent. And the current tournament you mentioned is Altabox Norway, right?
Yes.
So are you following that pretty closely?
Yeah.
Okay. So we won't get into the horse race aspect of it, because here we are recording on Wednesday night with one round to go, and this will come out Tuesday. So no need for us to make embarrassing predictions.
We'll know what we don't.
Yeah, exactly. But I did want to ask you, and I had mentioned to you beforehand that I would ask you about this, because one of the storylines that's emerging from this tournament is Magnus Carlsen made a little comment about a prearranged draws from Mamedyarov and Karjakin, saying he'd noticed it as a pattern in their games in the past. And I don't know if you'd call it an accusation, because I don't know how wrong it is. What's your opinion about prearranged draws at the elite level?
So that's a tricky question. I would say that for example, open events or things like this, they happen kind of all the time.
Yeah.
And it's almost unavoidable, especially when you have, you know, people who are, you know, very good friends or study people playing together, like, it's just something that's fairly common and it's hard to get rid of. In elite events, when they're being paid, like, quite a lot, it makes sense to really take extra steps to avoid it. But I can tell you that whenever you have two people who want to draw,
right,
and they're very strong, they can play 30 moves, they can play 40 moves, they can sit there for 2 hours. You can make it more annoying for them, but you're not going to stop them.
Yeah, and they can play like some cooked up, crazy looking game that will entertain the masses, sure, but still ends in a draw. Yeah.
Yeah,
but.
And the fact is that sometimes these things happen. Like, you can walk into someone's analysis and have to find a draw, and I don't think you should be penalized for that.
Right.
So I think that you're going to have some false positives and things like this. So, I mean, honestly, my solution, which doesn't sound very original, would be you keep an eye on these players and organizers keep an eye on these players and simply just don't give them invites at some point.
Wow.
Because then it's like you either, like, let them know, like, look, we've noticed this. We see any, you know, more games that are like it following this pattern. We're just not inviting you.
Wow. So just out of curiosity, had you noticed this between these two players?
I would say, like, certain players have more of a reputation for it than others. But it's honestly hard to tell because, like, a game like that, the one that they played, it was a really complicated line. It was clearly Karjakin's analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But Mamedjarov was spending so much time, it's at least possible that he didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very forcing line, and I would say he prepared rather poorly if it wasn't arranged. But you can never go 100% on these things, because it does happen that you walk into people's analysis. There are certain really well-known drawing lines where you're basically 100%. You know, and I would say that there are very few grandmasters who you will interview or you'll see who haven't done it at some point.
Right. Well, like you say, in open tournaments, yeah. I mean, you know, you need
I wish I could say I haven't, but I certainly have.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially in these 2-round-a-day tournaments that are common here in the States, you like managing your energy levels is part of the competition, basically.
Yeah. And my most recent one, actually, I hate to say this, but I was very sick during the tournament, and it was a round robin. So, basically, I could barely play.
Yeah.
I was basically offering and accepting draws at will. And it's like everyone's kind of been in that situation, and it's like, I would say that if it's a rare thing, and, you know, it shouldn't be too big a deal, but if there are people who are, you know, getting paid serious money, going up at events and doing this, then people should just not invite them because it's not good for fans. It's not good for how chess looks. You know, and if one of these players stops getting invited, I think that it'll at least send a message that, look, this isn't going to be acceptable.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But to me, that's really the only solution. You can do it, and you can only do it, of course, if there's a real clear pattern. But I just don't see any other way to do it because, honestly, any kind of rule you could set, they can get around.
Yeah, and obviously this, you know, things are moving in the right direction if we look back to, like, Soviet era, where, you know, not only draws were prearranged, but wins and losses sometimes, so.
And of course, I mean, that still certainly goes on in some places. It's not like that's completely behind us. You know, even in the U.S., even other places, like, it certainly, to say it doesn't happen would just be naive. But at the same time, I would agree that we're moving in the right direction. Now, of course, we have to worry about computer cheating, which they didn't.
Right, that's true. Yeah, I think mainly at the elite level, it's not that people have become more pure.
Yeah.
It's that the incentives aren't as strong to cheat as they used to be, at least at the very top level. But here in America, where people can be fighting for, you know, big prizes, you know, I'm sure that it happens, unfortunately.
I've competed in my share of Swiss tournaments, and, you know, there are certain pairings where you just know, oh, no.
That's like, funny.
Please don't.
Yeah, I guess you're probably not going to name names, but I'm sure.
Probably not a good idea, but people mostly know who they are. So.
That's interesting. So, like, within, you know, behind closed doors, like, players of
yours. I don't even know if it's behind closed doors. It's just, you know, people know, and certain people, you know, when they're paired in the last round, it's just super risky.
Right.
And, you know, some of them have been banned for it before, too. So it's not like it's first time for certain people. But I definitely know there was one tournament where I ended up sharing first, where maybe I should. Well, I shared it with two people and I probably should have shared with one. Let's put it
that way. Interesting. Yeah, that's annoying.
I've seen it happen. And it's kind of, but you have to, you know, as far as what, like, there's nothing I can really do about it, so it's like, okay, you shrug it off, and not doing it yourself is a good thing. But
yeah, and, you know, stewing about it probably isn't too productive.
I'm not much of a stewer.
That's
not really my thing, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it definitely can happen.
Yeah. So Josh, your name has come up a couple times on the podcast because you know, mm-hmm. your friend Jesse Cry mentioned yep. The Chess House back in San Francisco, and I think David mm-hmm. Proust mentioned you as well. So, mm-hmm. But now you're in Wisconsin. So one thing I wanted to find out about your background is how you ended up there.
So my journey was basically I grew up in New Hampshire, where I was for about – I probably should have looked at this before I got interviewed. But I was about 20 or so, 19, when I went to California. Basically, David Proust invited me. He got to Samford and he invited me to study with him. And I was teaching, but I was, you know, not doing a ton of local teaching and all this. So it seemed like a good opportunity. So I went and I moved to California and I studied chess with him for a while. Jesse ended up moving there later. I ended up studying with Binay Bhatt as well. And that's where the Chess House concept. I never actually lived in the Chess House. I get asked this all the time. What was it like to live in the Chess House? Did not live there. But I lived near them and I went over to study quite a bit, and it was kind of a good thing. But at some point, like, David didn't really play anymore. Jesse wasn't studying much. He was working on his book at the time and he was very busy. And it just didn't seem – it's an expensive place to live. I like Northern California. It's a nice place. But I was in El Cerrito specifically. But it was like, you know, nice place, but it's just too expensive. And at some point I got an offer. A friend of mine in Wisconsin, you know, has a company that teaches in schools and things like this. So he offered – this is Alex Bettinelli. He said, you know, why don't you move to Wisconsin if you're looking for a place and I can fix you up with some schools and things like that. So – that's how I ended up here.
Okay, and how long have you been there?
I've been here since 2011 is when I moved.
Okay, I'm guessing you do pretty well in the Wisconsin State Championships.
I don't usually play. I played this okay. last year, actually, because they kind of invited me and all of this. So I was like, all right, and it was across the street, literally.
Okay.
So I'm like, all right, I'd be kind of irresponsible not to play. So I usually avoid local tournaments. I just... You know, it kind of reminds me of when I used to play when I was much younger, and I would go to these events with bad air conditioning and you'd sit there and sweat for four games a day or something. And, you know, I felt like I'd earned to not play there anymore.
Right.
Like, usually badly run tournaments, not always. Some of them are good. But, you know, I was like, all right, I've earned not my place not to do this. So, but occasionally I'll go and it's like it's kind of a nostalgic thing a little bit. But But yeah, I did play this last year and I did win, but it wasn't a walk in the park. I gave up a draw to actually one of my roommates, Eric Santarius, who's very strong, like 2400-ish. And I almost lost in the last round to an expert who was playing like really nice game, and I ended up somehow swindling him, but it was not a walk in the park, but I okay. managed to win.
So I may take them lightly, but you know better. Lightly on your behalf, I should say.
No, I always assume the worst. I always assume that everyone can beat me. Like, it's right. just safer that way. Otherwise, for me, overconfidence is very bad. So
okay. I
assume everyone's super strong and they're going to kill me, and then I'm pleasantly surprised.
Nice. All right. Well, we'll get back to that. But one thing yeah. I wanted to get a little more detail on is, so you said you moved from New Hampshire to California. So did you go yes. to college at all, or did you go straight?
I did not. I went. I got a couple scholarships, you know, to the chess schools. I got into a couple other schools, but I didn't really, if I had something for sure I wanted to study in college, I would have done it. But I was interested in medicine, but I knew I didn't want to become a doctor. I was interested in, I had a lot of interests, but nothing I really wanted to do except for chess. Chess I knew I wanted to do. So most people I know who went to college ended up not doing so well with chess. So I decided, you know what, I can teach, I can make a living, and I'm going to do chess.
Yeah, that was the main thing I wanted to get a little more detail on from you is, I don't mm-hmm. know if you saw this quote from Hikaru about mm-hmm. Strong chess players going to college. It was just this week. Did you happen to see it?
No.
He was talking about some elite player who may be going to one of the schools in St. Louis, and he was saying, yeah. you know, if these guys go to college, you notice they stop getting stronger. And he kind of singled out Lekuang Liem, you know, about number 25 in the world, who's been going to college with a chess scholarship the past few years. But I found it interesting. I mean, A, that he just like named someone like that, but B, the general idea, because they are going for a chess program, but on the other hand, they have a lot of other responsibilities. Like, I had Yaroslav Zhurabek on, and you know, mm-hmm. the number of balls he was juggling was rather staggering. So
I'm truly impressed by the people who do this. Like, I know that I couldn't do it. Like, multitasking is not one of my strengths whatsoever. So it's you know, I just look at these people and I'm actually like super impressed. But really, like, what it comes down to is what they're there for. Like, there are some in the past and even currently who really are going, they're doing chess, they're coming here, they're getting a full ride, and they're basically wanting to do chess, and school is not their priority. One of the common tricks is that they take a language they already know.
Right, yeah, it's like an athlete.
So that's been done. The most famous case was when Wojciechowicz did it, who was in his 40s, and that was very fishy, but okay, I mean. But there are actually people I know who actually did go to college and do it, and like Liam, for example, is in that category, and from what I hear, I don't know him too well, but he works extremely hard, and he focuses on school, and he plays chess because that's how he got his scholarship, and he has to, but he's really there not to improve at chess, but to, you know, pursue his major. I forget exactly what it is at the moment. It escapes me, but
okay, so yeah,
he's there for college.
So it sounds like Hikaru's criticism is well-founded, and I'm sure he was, you know, aware of that background info that you just shared.
It's possible, but it's more like, you know, it's not necessarily that they're weaker because they're going to college and distracted. They're weaker because that's what they want to do. They're not actually trying to do chess.
Okay.
They're doing chess because they have to, but they really want to pursue college, and that's their focus. Whereas a professional chess player who is doing college, but just doing college, I'm sure they could improve just because they're not really as focused on the schooling. So
yeah, and there are resources there. I mean, if you have a coach like Onishuk or Susan Polgar preparing materials for you, and you have other strong players to study with.
I mean, it sounds like a great thing to me, just in terms of like you have all these great players to look at chess with. So that aspect sounds pretty cool. But if you have a bunch of busy people who are actually doing school, they don't always look at chess together as much.
Right.
But,
okay, so let's bring it back to Wisconsin. So you mentioned you do some school programs there. So what level players are you generally working with?
So at the moment, I'm actually not doing school so much anymore. When I first moved here, I did a bunch. I didn't have as many private students as I do now. And I did some schools, but to be honest, I didn't really enjoy it. It was a lot of the times it's more like babysitting than teaching.
Right.
And not that it's a bad job or anything like this. And obviously, you know, if you need money, it's a good thing. But it's like to have a GM do it is very weird because essentially that's not really what it is. And I was trying to do it and you know, some of the kids were pretty good and I was happy to do it. But the aspects of essentially you're babysitting kids for an hour is just not. You know, again, when I need money, of course, I would do that. You know, you have to make a living. But, you know, it's long, like at the moment, I have more students. I have more stuff going on and I've made more at tournaments. So it's like I would prefer to do that for a living. So essentially now I do teach some kids, but it's almost all private lessons or occasionally group lessons, things like that. I don't really do schools anymore.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, just having seen that YouTube video and a couple other of your presentations at the St. Louis Chess Club, it would be a waste of your talents to be focusing on just how the knight moves.
Sure. I mean, you know, and that's part of it. Like, you know, I want my skill set to be used, but a lot of it is also just, you know, enjoyment. Like, I enjoy teaching strong students or, you know, giving one-on-one lessons to even like an adult who's like 50, but really is passionate about the game. I enjoy that. But when it comes to like babysitting kids who don't really have interest, like this is just not fun. So if I can avoid it financially, I will. Right.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So it's not just about talents being used. It's largely just,
it's not
how I want to be living. So
yeah, makes sense. So when you do work with your students, Josh, you know, our listeners are always eager for any nugget of wisdom about how to improve their game. So what's your general approach with a student? Like if you
top
have
top secret, I don't know.
are you familiar with
stuff? No, I mean, my theory is like people can have their own ideas, but essentially people teach the way they were taught. That's what I've discovered. You know, and my focus and I think a lot of players also is like, you know, going over your games was the first thing. So if you're playing tournament games, you go over every single one. And that's the way you improve. And one of the things is that it sounds one-dimensional, but you can work it into so many things. Like if you have a game where, all right, here's an opening lesson because you messed up this opening. Here's a position in the middle game. Try to think about what you could have done here. Here's an end game. This is how this kind of end game works. So you can actually take one game and work on every aspect of the game and make it personal because they've experienced it. They knew what they were thinking. So basically, I would say my approach is centered around, especially for tournament players is who I teach. going over their games. There are some students who that's pretty much all I do. There are other students who they don't play as much, so I design, you know, I do give them problems, I do training type stuff, I show them specific positions or openings, but I would say that for the most of them, it really is centered around self-study.
Okay, and getting tying it in with your YouTube series that, mm-hmm. that you've begun, Autopsy, like, mm-hmm. would you say that focusing on what the critical mistake was or what was misunderstood, is that like a theme that runs through your teaching?
Yes, I would say that that's what I focus on in most of the games. I would say especially, you know, because students can look at the computer and they'll see what they did wrong right away. Like, it doesn't make sense to just point out mistakes. And I have some students who are clearly are annoyed that I have them think about what went wrong a little more.
Right.
But it's basically, at least for me, like, I think it's just, I know it's what I have to do. So I just think that that's what ends up being more useful, because it's so easy to check your games tactically or where your mistakes were. Like, you can just plug it into a computer. So my job, I feel like, is to actually make them think about things a computer can't tell you. Like, okay, you played this move, but why did you play this move? Like, what did you miss? And was it just tactical? Were you thinking about the position wrong? Were you misevaluating? Did you think you were better when you were in fact worse? And those are the factors that often lead to mistakes, sometimes more than just not seeing something.
Okay. So is there...
It's a little complicated. Sometimes you just miss a tactic and that's the way it goes. But a lot of the times there's a error in how you're thinking that kind of precedes that.
So is there like one mistake that you, or one sort of cognitive error that, or misunderstanding that you see more commonly in your students than others?
I would say it's looking at, not looking at the whole position. Like, for example, I get, this is one I get all the time. I'll ask, okay, why didn't you go for this position? They'll be like, say I have doubled pawns. And there's a whole position with tons of stuff going on. One side has the two bishops. One side has a slight initiative, et cetera, et cetera. But just because of the doubled pawns, they didn't go for this line.
Right.
And so I would say, like, you know, they have their, you know, eyes too close to the ball. It's like, you know, you got to look at the whole field, like, what's going on? And I would say, like, getting them to look at the whole board, assess the whole situation before making decisions rather than focus on one or two things. Because when people are beginners, they're taught all these concepts like don't double your pawns, control the center, do all this, because most of the time that's all correct, right?
Right.
But the more you learn, the more everything is situational, and there are so many aspects in a given position, and the problem is you actually have to beat that stuff out of people. You yeah. notice GMs break these rules all the time, and there's right. a reason for it. We're not just like, we're GMs, we can do what we want. It's more like, you know, sometimes it's like that. But
yeah, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Yeah, that's something exactly. that John Watson has written about mm-hmm. a lot, common theme of his. And yeah, I mean, humans are wired to look for shortcuts, for heuristics. So it's, you know, you're always going to be, it's always going to be an uphill climb to learn to get rid of them. But yeah, I agree that that's,
yeah.
you know, and that's what
very,
separates.
I can't pretend to be an expert in brain science or anything like this, but I am very interested in that kind of thing. There's a lot of this in the book, Thinking Fast and Slow. You've probably
right.
heard of this book.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great book.
And I like a lot of that stuff. Again, I'm not by no means an expert in any of it, but it's interesting, and I can definitely see a lot of it in how people make mistakes in chess. But yeah, a lot of it is just they focus on one thing or they don't do something for some whatever dogmatic reason. But if you look at the position a little deeper, it's obvious this is the lesser evil, or doesn't matter. I mean, double pawns don't matter all the time, but so many people just don't do it because they're double.
Yeah, and they might not even, like, their analysis might just stop there, you know.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so in terms of resources, people always want book recommendations, or if there's like a favorite presenter online, is there or like material that you draw from? What are your favorite resources to recommend both to your students?
So I get asked this a lot, and yeah. it's one of those questions I kind of hate just because right? everyone says the same thing. Like,
yeah,
you know. So I would say, I mean, everyone has what works for them. I would say, like, you know, I definitely use, like, have some kind of tactics, like tactics books or tactical website. I mean, I use like Chess Tempo and chess.com, and it doesn't even matter. Just have tactics that you're doing regularly, like every day. Doesn't matter what book. Like, I don't even care if it's a bad book with lots of mistakes. Then you have to figure them out.
Right.
Just any tactics, you have to be doing tactics all the time. So doesn't matter what website you use. As far as books that actually had an impact on me, I mean, I would say Road to Chess Improvement by Alex Jermolinsky I really like, because that really involved like a lot of the opening stuff he mentioned in there was either outdated or some of it I actually think was wrong. But it doesn't even matter. It's more about a way to think about chess, like kind of things that are a little bit deeper that, you know, you can actually ways that people go wrong and ways to correct how you think about chess. Just I found that a lot of the stuff in there was interesting and also, you know, unique content. But as far as training books, like I use Agard books, I've used Doretsky, I've gone over all that, and it's all good. Like to give one recommendation, I feel would be robbing people a little bit. One thing I would say though, which I recommend a lot, is do not stay on one book. A lot of people, they'll say, all right, I'm doing this book. The problem is that every author has their own tendencies. Like Agard, for example, I don't care if it's his positional book. The dude is crazy concrete. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at, because I work with Alex Goulden sometimes, and we were laughing at one of his books because there were positional exercises and half of them were completely tactical. Like they were these concrete ideas which had, like, were anti-positional, I would say, if anything, but they were correct. There was nothing wrong with them and it was really cool problems. But for us, it was like laughable that he would call it positional, but from his point of view, it probably was. So, but like, for example, you get used to authors' tendencies and then you kind of cheat. And we don't do it on purpose, but that's just the way it goes. Like any kind of book, like, you know, for example, I really liked Gaprindishvili's book with Imagination and Chess, which has a lot of really neat problems, but there's a pattern to them. And once you lock onto the pattern, you solve it easier and you're not learning as much. So one of the things I do is I jump.
Okay.
Like all the time, I'm doing different books all the time. And, you know, so I'd say that that's a big recommendation, not to just do one book to jump around, because then you don't get locked onto these patterns. It encourages you to think in different ways.
That's interesting. And that's original advice here on this podcast.
I was trying.
Yeah, 77th interview.
I just want to say a book that everyone's saying, you know? So
yeah. Well, Deborah, I mean, I'm with you when you say, like, you know, it's not your favorite question, because I ask because people want the recommendations, but I sort of feel the same way. I mean, it's more how you study than what you study, in my opinion.
I would say for sure. And another one I would say is, like, have, like, I really like game collections. So
yeah.
Have what inspires you. Like for example, I really liked, one of my favorite books I read when I was young was the Piatigorsky Cup, the second Piatigorsky Cup. It was a, you know, super tournament. Spassky ended up winning over Fischer, and just the annotated games. It was even in old notation, which for me was a problem
because I didn't learn
it. I wasn't quite, you know. But I mean, I learned how to read it, of course, but for this book. But it was just such a, you know, really cool book, and the annotations are really nice and all of this. And just, you know, maybe for other people this book would be nothing, but for me it was like I read that book and I wanted to play chess.
Nice.
So finding books like that, regardless of what it is, I mean, I really like game collections. I like Karras's games a lot. He happens to be a favorite of mine, but find a player you like, study their games, like anything that makes you want to look at chess and want to do all that, like that's the book you should be reading.
So what do you like about Karras's games?
I really like that he's universal. He's, you know, you couldn't pigeonhole him. Like you couldn't say, all right, he's an attacker. Yes, he's a great attacker, but there are so many games like he's not aiming to attack. There are games where he plays really positionally. He defended really resourcefully, but he was also good at pressing, you know, slowly for a win. He really ran the spectrum and was as very close to a universal player. He definitely had his own style, but I just really liked his games just for the fact that, you know, he really did it all.
And so
nice player.
And so, Josh, what's going on with your own chess? Like, I saw that, you know, sometimes it doesn't tell the full story, but it looks like your FIDE rating's pretty close to its peak. You still managed to play a decent amount. So, like, are you still working on your game a good amount?
For sure. It's, you know, it's a work in progress. I'd say, like, especially, you know, to be honest, like, okay, I already got to a pretty strong level. I'm over 30. So the odds of me improving, if you just look at the numbers, are not great. But I would say in the last couple of years, I've had more success. And a lot of it is that I'm, you know, is to do with work. But I mean, I always have put in some study. Like I'm never studying, right? But I wouldn't say I've been studying more lately or anything like that. And that's what led to greater results or anything like that. You know, I'm always working on my chess, and, you know, I have people I work with sometimes and things like this. But it's more, I kind of focused on, I would say I play less than I did like 5 years ago. 5 years ago, I used to play like an event a month, say. Now I'd say I play an event every 2 months, maybe.
Okay.
So I'm not super active, but I discovered that that actually works nicely for me, because at some point I was playing a lot and every tournament kind of felt like a grind, and I would be professional and I would go there well prepared and I would play my openings and I would, you know, do the stuff. But I just, it just felt like too much of a grind. Like, it just wasn't really that enjoyable. And I, you know, I always liked chess, so it wasn't that, that wasn't the problem. but it just, I was playing too much. And at this point, I go out of my way. I don't, if there's a tournament I don't like, I don't feel like I have to play it. I just won't play it.
Okay.
So I don't force myself to play. So essentially, if I see a tournament I like, I'll play it. If I see, you know, there's an organizer who is, I really goes out of their way for the players. I like events like that. So, you know, I'll play in places I want to go. Like, say, Reykjavik Open, it's a strong event. It's a cool place to visit. I want to go there.
Yeah.
So basically, I end up playing places I like and when I want to. And because I don't play as often, I'm always kind of wanting to play in fresh. Occasionally, I'm a bit more rusty than I used to be, so that can be a problem. But I found that that's kind of my approach now, that I'm doing it for a living, sort of, but really, to be realistic, at my strength, to make a living from playing is very difficult.
Right.
I'm not quite strong enough.
So who else, or who, like, where or who else? You mentioned they're focusing on either places you like or organizers. Is there any one in particular you'd also like to highlight besides Reykjavik, whether an organizer or a place?
I mean, you know, I always enjoy playing. I mean, essentially, overseas tournaments are mostly nicer. So, mm-hmm. you know, if I can find an event that's in a place, you know, I always like playing in Greece. I haven't played there in a little while, but, like, for example, a place like that, it would be something I would be interested in. You know, it obviously, if it's too expensive or they don't give good conditions, it's just harder. But, you know, and I would say in the U.S., though, there are more organizers, like people, like, okay, for example, in the summer, there's Washington International run by Mike Regan, and then U.S. Masters run by Walter High. And I would say, like, the conditions I get aren't, like, out of this world or anything like this, but the organizers put in effort to welcome players, to make their events strong, to, you know, do extra things. And I just appreciate that. Like, it's a rare thing, especially here. So,
Okay. You
know, I can't always make it. Like, this year I'm making Washington International, but I don't think I'll be able to make U.S. Masters. And it's not that I don't want to go. It's just, it's not going to work with my schedule. But it's more like I'd be more inclined to support events like that.
Gotcha. And what would be, like, for a player at your level, what would be good, what would you consider good conditions?
So good conditions, like, okay, like, I would say it depends on the style of event, because obviously a really big open tournament with big prizes, I can't expect very much. But, you know, I would say it also depends, because in the U.S., the conditions are far worse as far as what you get. But I would say, like, for example, if they throw, you know, hotel room, or they throw up, you know, $200 or $300 in the U.S., that's like, you know, that's at least reasonable. Like, they're making an effort to get players. Unfortunately, I'm U.S. Federation, so for norm events, I'm not as useful.
Mm-hmm.
So foreign players can expect more. But, you know, if they throw in, like, a little bit of money, they throw an hotel, something like this, which a lot of the organizers who do that will do, then to me, that's at least, okay, that's something that is an incentive for me to go, even if it's not, in the end, that much money. Like, they can't afford to. Like, they just don't have enough money to pay everyone, like, a ton, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, and you're not looking to get rich, you know?
Yeah, I mean, St. Louis would be the exception. They have better conditions at events like that, but they have money. So, obviously, events like that are excellent just because they're well-run. It's at a nice club. They provide good conditions. But you can't expect everyone to have that kind of financial backing, so.
Yeah, for sure. So, what is what's on your current schedule? What do you have coming up?
So in the summer, I have U.S. Open. It's not a tournament I like, but it's in Madison, so I can stay with a friend. And
yeah. What don't you like about it?
It's, I mean, just the not, first just four too rounds, many, I'm playing like 1,700, 1,900, right. 2,100. It's just,
as soon as I just, asked the question, I realized the answer. Yeah.
It's particularly weak, and it's also so much luck. Like, to have 8 and a 9 to even tie for first, it's just kind of silly, you know?
Yeah.
That's not really a tournament. I mean, in my eyes, that's just, it is a tournament, and it, you know, I won it once. Obviously, it's doable, but it's like, to me, it felt very lucky because I, you know, I lost to Lenderman, for example. I was 6-0. I started really well. I beat Sidora, but then I lost to Lenderman kind of terribly. So I was like, oh, I guess my tournament's over. But I won, like, I played down the last two games, and I was black in the last game against an IM. It wasn't like it was that easy, but it was like I got a little lucky with, you know, not playing a GM in the last round. I ended up winning. Then it got to a tiebreak, and then I could have just not made it, but I ended up making it. And then, you know, you play an Armageddon game after waiting around 2 hours.
Right.
And I won it, you know, again, like, you know, Mac dropped a piece. It wasn't like I did anything amazing, but it was like, you know, to me, it's just there's so much luck. And it's obviously if you play really well and you just crush everyone, you're great. But it's just not really my type of event. Like, you know, if you get 7 out of 9 tie for first, that's different. That's like a more reasonable score. If you have to score 8 out of 9, the tournament's a little fishy.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I just want to say to listeners, that's sort of like, that's the pro perspective you're getting, because Josh, yes. I mean, he's playing, you know, for him to be pared down 700 points, nothing good can really come of it. No offense to whoever he's playing.
No, I mean, and occasionally, like, I actually checkmated in 16 moves with black last time, which was kind of enjoyable, but... It's not, yeah. It's just something I don't experience very often.
Right.
But at the same time, it's not, yeah, these are not really great games. And,
yeah,
you know, but, it's just, as a tournament goes, as far as interesting games and strength, and as far as like what you need to do to win, it's just not really great.
Yeah,
like,
it's honestly, not a great fit.
There's a U.S. championship spot, which is
that's what I was, one yeah, of the I was, main incentives. I was going to ask about how big an incentive that
yeah.
was.
And also, like, if I get into U.S. championship, that also provides me incentive, because it's like, Josh, you got to get better, man. You're
right,
you're
yeah.
going to get slaughtered in an event like that if you don't improve. I always played well at U.S. championship also, but obviously it's stronger now than whenever I played. So
yeah, but when it's in your backyard, I guess it makes sense to take a
for
shot.
For the U.S. Open, I'll do it. And it's one of the reasons I'm not ending up playing U.S. Masters, probably just because I have that in Washington International. To do 3 events in a month would be already a lot as far as, you know, just being away from teaching and doing all this. So
yeah. That makes sense. All right, yeah. So we have a question from Mike Klein of chess.com.
Mm-hmm. I'm not answering any of Mike's questions.
So, and by the way, before we get to Mike's question, I just want to give a shout out to his new podcast. If anyone listening hasn't caught wind of it, if you like travel, you should check it out. It's called Extreme Travel Odysseys. It's kind of weird to listen to it and listen to Mike for 45 minutes, never mention chess. But yeah, it's an enjoyable side project that Mike just launched. But his question, of course, actually isn't chess related, but it's tennis related. So why do so many top players enjoy tennis?
I'm really not sure. I mean, people compare it to a chess match when I'm watching it on TV all the time.
And yeah, they sure do.
You know, right. But there is a first of all, it's like, you know, obviously there's doubles, which I enjoy a lot also. But it's more like there's a one-on-one aspect, which a lot of sports don't have. There is definitely strategy as far as shot selection and things like that go. So it could be that, but it could be random also. I don't know. It feels like speculation, but there is some strategy. But to say there's no strategy in baseball would, you know, be shortchanging the game, right? So it's like, I really don't know.
But you just like it.
I definitely like it. I played it for a long time. You know, I play leagues during the summer and things like that, so... It's definitely like a major interest I have. So.
Gotcha. Yeah, and your Twitter bio says you're a chess grandmaster and tennis and cooking non-grandmaster. So
yeah, I mean, well, okay, I have lots of things I study and do, but like I would say those are the two things I do maybe best, I want to say. Like, you know, as far as other than chess, like tennis and cooking are so like major interests, which I do regularly.
What would your ratings be in those?
So in cooking, it's impossible to say. you know, everyone has their own things there, you know, I like, for example, I made pizza tonight, which is relatively new. And it's like, they taste pretty nice, but you would take one look at them and be like, a professional did not make this.
Right.
Whereas some other things I make, you know, for example, I smoke chicken and stuff like that, which is, or roast chicken, like certain types of dishes I'm particularly good at, and those I think are at a pretty high level. So you can't really rate them. I'd say between, you know, 1200 and 1900.
Okay. That's a wide range.
I have no idea. It's really hard to say. I'm better at some things than others. As far as tennis goes, I would say I can do it a bit. I would say I'm between, like, probably not expert, but above B player. So A player-ish range at tennis, I would say.
Okay.
So basically, like, I can beat most club players.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like strong club player, essentially. So I'm not going to, you know, challenge Federer anytime soon, but I'm better than your average person. So.
Okay. Yeah. And able to appreciate it probably a little more than.
It's one of the reasons I watch tennis a lot, too, because it's just I actually know what's going on. Like there is. It's a little different.
Right. So you could do an autopsy tennis series as well.
Yeah. It wouldn't be quite as accurate, but.
Well, yeah. Long as it's entertaining, it doesn't matter.
I'll make it entertaining, that's for sure.
So your student, Chris Wainscott, tipped me off that you also coach Sam Shankland a bit.
I used to. It was a long time ago. When I first moved to the Bay Area, David was like, yeah, so there's this kid who's you know, pretty talented. You want to work with him occasionally? We kind of pass him off between each of us.
Right.
So Benai worked with him a little bit, then David. So he's like, why don't you take a shot? I'm like, I think they were just handing him off. They didn't want to deal with him anymore. But
because he was too strong or what?
Well, he was strong, you know, and he was very strong-willed too. So it was like, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, teaching him could be rewarding, but it was very challenging. Like he was really already like very, you know, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but he was already very, like you had to convince him that you were right sometimes.
Huh.
And it took a lot of convincing.
And what was his rating like around this time?
At the time I started teaching him, he was about 2100.
Okay. So,
I'd say I taught him between, he was, you know, 2100 to 2350. And obviously he increased at a huge, because he started kind of late, but then he got better at a very, it was clear he was extremely talented. So he got better at a very rapid rate. But I was just one of many guys who helped out. And like to say I was like his main coach would be probably not right. But I definitely worked with him for a couple years on and off. Largely informally, some formally, but. Oftentimes it would be like we'd look at chess a couple hours in the park and he'd buy me lunch or something.
Right.
So well, Josh, was, you know, but he was strong enough that it was definitely, you know, a fun thing to do.
Josh, if he keeps putting up results like he has been, you're going to need to reframe this narrative. You're going to have to.
Don't worry, I'm working on it. I have like, yes, I took him as a young boy and escorted him across the Atlantic and then. Right. I took him to all the best. Yeah, I have it all worked out, but I'm actually currently writing it. So
nice. So what do you make of this? I feel like it's pretty rare. I mean, you know, hovering around 70 in the world for years, and now, I mean, he's pushed to like 25 in like a matter of months. I mean, it's amazing.
Well, I mean, that happens. Like people make, I would say inclines are very rarely, you know, steady. Like everyone plateaus and then goes up and then goes. And the thing is, he was at like 20, between 2630 and 2670, say for a while, but it wasn't that long. I mean, a few years, maybe 3-4 years. Like, I don't feel like it was, you know, forever. There are certainly players who got stuck for a lot longer. So it was a surprise to me that he was able to break through. So like, cause one of the things he struggled with was, you know, he could hold his own with very strong players, but he would almost never, ever beat anyone over 2700. Like that was just, he would draw them all the time, but he told me, at least this is what he told me, it wasn't something I noticed necessarily, but just to beat them was something he hasn't figured out. And even now, I guess he hasn't beaten that many, but he's really going to town on the 2600s.
Right.
So I guess that's enough, you know. If you can beat the 2600s every time, you're gonna get
especially with
high
black
rate.
And
again, like, you know, he'd have streaks where he wouldn't lose for a while, but he would draw lots of games, which is weird to me because his style when he was young and even now, like, it never struck me as solid. But I think he just doesn't make a lot of large errors. And he's usually very well prepared in the opening. So these two factors make him very difficult to beat on their own. Like, he doesn't blunder and he's good, well prepared. It's just kind of tough.
Yeah, well, it's fun to watch. I mean, I hope he gets more invites and it'll make the Olympiad more interesting, too. I mean, to have him at board four.
For sure. I mean, okay, we already have so many strong players, you know, and we might be getting more. Like, there's always rumors that someone's going to switch federations. So he might not, you know, I think he'll make it, you know, U.S. champion, obviously, 2715. But, you know, it's still pretty fierce. So, I mean, our Olympiad team's looking better every year. It's quite something.
Yeah, it'll be interesting this year.
And we might have a world champion on it at some point.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah, of course. So as I mentioned to you before the interview, I feel like we have to talk about the world championship, but I'm already getting tired of just asking people who, you know, having every person say Magnus is a small favorite.
Yeah.
So what I thought maybe you could talk about a little bit is what openings fans can expect. I mean, there's one obvious to me, but I mean, I'll let you answer the question.
That's actually tricky. To me, it's not obvious at all. And the main reason is because if you look at world championship history, almost every player, even someone like Gelfand, who's extremely, he's like, I have my systems, I know them better than you, and that's all I'm playing. He learned a whole new opening, right? So again, someone like Fabiano,
what did he play against Anand? Forgive my ignorance, but so yeah. what did he unveil when?
So
he played
the Grünfeld, which he never really played much of at all against Anand, like right off the bat, and that was the opening he used for the match,
right?
And this is someone, again, who's a really great studier and is a versatile player, but usually sticks to his one set of systems. So for him to play something entirely new was unexpected. Now, you have someone like Fabiano and like Magnus, who I'd say are far more flexible opening-wise than Gelfand is. I think they could play anything. Obviously, he's been grooming the Petrov, and it's going well for him, and it's very possible he could use it, but he could also switch up entirely. He could play Carol Kahn all match, unlikely,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the Petrov was the one that I was thinking of, just for the record. But yeah.
No, it very may happen, but it could also be, you know, he'll be like, look, I'm playing it a bunch, and I'm doing well with it, but this is what he's going to be beefing up for, so I'm going to actually switch it up, and he's maybe, at the even right now, like learning something else. But what I'm interested more in is not necessarily the specific opening, just the approaches, because I feel like they both have such different opening approaches. I'm really anxious to see how they'll clash, because it's like Magnus is really largely about, okay, I have my types of positions. He likes E4, E5, Lopez-type stuff. He likes, you know, Nimzo-ish structures, that kind of thing. And, you know, he's like, I just want to get a position. I don't care if I'm better or not. I can be slightly worse as black. It's fine. I just want a position where I can work with, like where the plans are slower, where everything is, you know, I can improve the game at my pace. I don't have to worry about the board opening up right away. Whereas Fabiano is very much like, I'm going to try to play the best moves, and I'm fine playing aggressive and playing concrete, and I'll memorize all lines all day.
Right.
and of course he can also kind of mix it up, but it's like, I mean, it's funny because I was going to say that, but then today he played a line which he knew was dubious, so who knows. But it's also, he's very much a believer, though, in just strong moves winning in the end. So it's like, but I feel like his approach to openings is far more concrete. So I feel like it's going to be a battle between Fabiano wants to really, you know, make the game forcing right away and have it be about homework and stuff like that. Whereas I really feel like Magnus wants to just get a position, like just get something I can work with, outplay. And it'll be interesting to me, like, who kind of wins that battle. But usually world championship matches are weird too, because they usually start with like, they play a few BS openings at the beginning just to kind of feel things out. Like, all right, what have you prepared? What's going on? They'll play King's Indian attack early or English or just slightly off kilter stuff right away. But I don't think Fabiano is going to do that. I think he's going to come in full blast. And I don't know. I think it'll be really interesting to see how Magnus handles him and how it differs, because it's a totally different thing than when you play in tournaments. It really is.
So do you have any experience? Like, I mean, obviously not in a world championship match, but like, have you had much match play in your career?
Match play? No. It's something, if you're not playing for the world championship, you don't really get match play.
Yeah.
The only match I played was a mini match in the World Cup against Wang Hao, which I can't say it was super pleasant. I ended up missing a flight because they canceled on me, and then, you know, barely getting there the day before, and then he refuted my preparation over the board, which is always annoying. And you know, I didn't really show my best chess, and also he's much stronger than me, so
right.
It was not pretty.
Bad combination.
No, it was really bad. I did not represent myself too well. That was 2009, That was the only real match I played, like, you know, apart from, you know, random blitz stuff and all that. I mean, you just don't get to play matches. It's just not a format that most people play almost ever. So occasionally there'll be invites to play them, but it's not, you know, usually I wouldn't be one of those people getting an invite for that. Right. It's usually either stronger or more, say, like players who are more well-known or whatever. So
right. So You just mentioned this tournament at the World Cup, which doesn't sound like your fondest memory. What are your fondest memories in your career?
To be honest, it wasn't like that bad as far as like, it's an experience. Like, I'm glad, you know, I can say I went to the World Cup. I lost, got killed by Wang Hao. I went over the game afterwards with him, and he spouted out like 20 move variations in a second. And I'm like, oh, that's what good chess is.
Okay. Right.
You know, and he's actually he's a nice guy. I've known him a little while. So it wasn't that unpleasant. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but I just didn't play very well. As far as good memories, I mean, winning US Open was something just because it got me into it, and it was such a presser situation because it's essentially I'm playing one Armageddon game for a US championship spot.
Right.
I mean, there was $200 or something also, but I mean, whatever, right? And Mac ended up getting a wild card, which I thought was a good thing because it was like, I mean, an Armageddon game is so random.
So that's Mac Molnar?
Yeah, Mac Molnar, and he ended up getting an invite anyway. But it was like, it was to play one game for all of that, and I'd never done that before. It wasn't like I play Armageddons all the time. It's not, you know.
So did you get to pick, or did he pick?
He picked black, which surprised me, because it was like, it wasn't that much time. It was like 4 versus 3, and he picked the 3, and I was like, or maybe it was 5-4, I don't remember. But it was no increment or delay, so it's like, that's risky. And I played pretty quickly, and he blundered a piece, and then it was, I mean, I had to win, but it was pretty easy.
So for listeners who don't know, the way an Armageddon playoff works is one side gets less time and the other side gets to pick. I mean, black gets less time and then gets to pick the color. Basically, one player picks the color. So it's like, do you want a time disadvantage, but draw odds or not? I did not do a good job explaining that.
People get it. Basically, if you're black, you can draw, but usually you have less time.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for explaining it in English.
For me, it was the first it's the only one I've ever played. Whereas you take someone, even for example, like you interviewed Tata, right? She's played probably several Armageddon games. And
right.
Because she's tied for the U.S. women's a zillion times. And it's like, yeah. She doesn't have pleasant experience in him, obviously, you know, but it was like, she's played him, you know, she knows the deal. And like players like that sometimes have that experience. But for most players, you know, say around where I am, like an Armageddon game is very rare.
Right.
You know, but I did want to tie for first in an event, but even then, most events don't do that. Honestly, Armageddon is kind of, it's not a great way to do things just because it's really counter to what chess is. But at the same time, you got to break a tie at some point and. I guess
I find that I like them. I find them entertaining.
They're definitely entertaining. But it was just, I think that he was, and I, you know, cause I talked to him afterwards, he's a friend of mine or whatever, but it just like the nerves really can get a hold of you. And I think that happened with him a little bit. And it was just, you know, it makes it hard to think, maybe one of the only things I did well that game was I just, you know, I'm kind of kept cool and I tend to be relatively relaxed even in those situations. So it was at least I could, you know, make do. But it's really so much luck. Like, it could have gone either way so easily. Again, unless you're talking players who are used to that, doing that often, and they can bring their best chess to it. But it's rare. Usually it's just about keeping your nerve a little bit.
Right. And you mentioned being surprised he took black. I sort of thought the conventional wisdom is that you should take black. I don't think so.
It really depends on time control. If you don't have increment or delay, getting actually flagged is a big problem. So, for example, if it's 4 minutes to 3 minutes and there's no delay, you'd be insane to take black.
Oh, okay.
Like, that's a whole extra minute. That's a lot of time. And I think it was 5-4. I don't remember.
Right, yeah,
exactly,
5-4 I feel like is more common.
But. So I was like, man, you do not. But I think that, you know, he just had more faith maybe in holding with the black pieces. You know, maybe he thought, Josh's black repertoire is better than white repertoire. But I doubt anything went into it like that. I think he just thought that it was safer or whatever. But I would have for sure taken white, so I wasn't unhappy.
Okay. All right, so Josh, just a couple more questions, if you don't mind. So I asked you about career highlights, but I also sort of similar vein, but not the exact same question. Do you have any like brushes with like chess legends, like any, you know, in your time in St. Louis or from your travels, like any memorable experiences with you know, famous and you know, chess players that our listeners always want
to
hear about.
I'm a bit boring in that because I just haven't had that many brushes, even with like the top players today. Like I just haven't, you know, I haven't met most of them. Like, I know Fabiano, I know, but mainly that's cause like, you know, he's kind of a friend of mine. Like we hang out when we're in St. Louis, you know, with a group of people who are also friends. And it's like, so I know him personally, but that's, you know,
right.
That's about as much as it gets. I don't know too many of them. As far as like, you know, people I would hang out with or anyone who I've, as far as past champions, I mean, I there was a funny one. I did meet Kasparov. It was kind of funny though how it happened because it was like, basically it went with a friend of mine. kind of dragged me to his book signing. And, you know, she wanted a book signed or whatever. And so, you know, basically we were there and then we met Mig, who, in case people don't know, that's like, you know, he does Kasparov's press, I think.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. He does lots of things for him. So, and I knew Mig, right? And so he was like, oh, Josh, whatever. And then, you know, he actually, like, got the person who I was with's name wrong in any way, but we won't get into that. but basically, he introduced, we went up to, you know, Kasparov, right? And he introduced me as America. It was just after I became a GM. And, you know, he said, like, this is America's newest GM. And Kasparov was like, wow, that's impressive. Like, super sarcastic. Like, yeah, that's Kasparov. And so that was kind of my and of course, then the person I was with went up to him, and then he was all smiley, you know.
Right.
So I'm like, uh-huh.
I'm very glad you shared that story.
Yeah, that was kind of the one.
Just in case you were thinking you were better than Kasparov,
he put you in your place. Impressive. I'm like, yeah, dude, I know it's not that impressive to you, but come on. Behave yourself for 2 seconds.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, the only other one I have actually is I was with my dad at Amateur Team East. And it was basically like he doesn't know chess or anything like this, so he just was there taking me there basically. And that was the year where Karpov played, and he had a team of him, Henley, and Krush, and then like some random 1200. And it was, but it was a big deal, Karpov playing, right?
Of course.
So then there was this, you know, I saw, like, I was looking for my dad, and I saw he was in the restaurant, and he was like casually chatting with this dude. And my dad's like opposite of me. Like, I'm very antisocial, he's extremely social. He's the type, you know, he would go up to a bar and he'd, you know, talk to everyone type of thing. And he was just chatting, and then I look and it's Karpov. And afterwards I'm like, Dad, you know, you're chatting with Karpov. He's like, oh, I just thought it was just another dude.
So did he know who Karpov was?
No.
I mean, when you said the name, did
no,
he,
when like... I said the name, he kind of knew, but it was okay. Like, I'm like, yeah, he was a world champion, blah, blah, blah. So, but from then on, he called him Jad, like just another dude.
That's hilarious.
So okay. I don't even know what they talked about. It was the weirdest thing.
That's funny. And like, yeah, people like that. It's like they have a better chance of becoming like buddy-buddy with him than like an introvert like you or me, because we would be like pestering him with questions about his career and stuff.
I wouldn't even go up. I'd just be like, hey, man, what's up?
Yeah, but I mean, even if you ended up in a conversation with him,
I'd be nervous though, because I know who he is and all this, but, right. Know, whereas someone else, but I don't have too many brushes with.
Well, those were great.
Those are the two which
you've done. Done your duty. I mean, great stories about Kasparov and Karpov.
Yeah, well, the Kasparov one is very classic because most people who know him were like, "Yeah, I believe that."
Yeah. Okay, so last thing, Josh, is that according to the internet, you learned chess at age 3.
Hmm?
I just
wanted to... right. I never thought I would say this.
Amazing. I mean, so did you like, I mean, obviously I don't expect you to remember yourself, but you know, the legend in your family, did you understand checkmate when you were 3?
Apparently, like I was very, I mean, again, the legend in my family could be false. Who knows? But it's basically, apparently I was, one of my uncles got a set and, you know, and it was like, you know, I was just after my 3rd birthday around, because I was born in December and it was around Christmas, right? So it was like just after my 3rd birthday, and one of my uncles got a set, and they didn't really play, but they just played around. And apparently I was just watching and I didn't take my eyes off it at all. And then I asked them to teach me, and apparently I learned the moves in 1 or 2 hours. Again, I have no idea if that's actually true. But basically the story is that I just kept playing everyone in my family till no one, like I just beat everyone and then I got a teacher.
Okay.
So essentially that was the story. As far as knowing checkmate and all the details, I don't know, but apparently they taught me the rules in a couple hours. I don't know if that's actually factual. Huh.
So my son is 5 and it's not entirely clear if he knows what checkmate is.
Checkmate's really hard. I mean, it's one of those things that, like, it's why checkers is a lot easier to explain, because you just take everything. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Some teachers I know actually do that with chess. At first, you just take everything, and only later do they explain checkmate, which to me is, I don't know, I don't think I'd do that, but checkmate's a tough thing, because it's when I tell kids, like, oh, you can't take the king in chess, they're like, what?
Yeah, yeah, it's very confusing.
It is. That's a tough one, I think, for anyone. And I, again, I have doubts that I understood everything perfectly at three. That sounds false. But
so
I shouldn't
give up on my son's chess just yet.
No. I mean, well, I told you about Shanklin, right? Like, he learned the moves when he was like 12.
Yeah.
I worked with Larry Christensen, someone. I'm pretty sure he was in his late teens. Or something like that when he really started. So it's like, I mean, five, I wouldn't be.
No, I was mostly, I was mostly kidding. But
just in case, yeah, I would not be panicking.
I'm not a stage dad, so not that important to me. But but I was curious about the learning in three thing.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, Josh, this was excellent. I think we've covered everything on this here list of mine.
Oh, that's good to hear.
So I definitely encourage listeners to check out your YouTube series, and I encourage you to stick with it. I mean, these things, you know, sometimes they can start slowly, but I mean, as someone who hosts a podcast and feel like a reasonable number of people listen to it, but then when I look at the number of views that these YouTube chess videos get, they're like astronomical. I mean, so... Yeah.
Well,
so,
I mean, just your podcast has really taken off. Almost everyone I knew, like, I get asked regularly whether I've been on it, and then I'm like... They're like, why aren't you on it yet? And I'm like, I don't know. You know,
it's all my fault. Sorry, everyone.
No, but it's just, you know, I'm like, well, they're getting people like Polgar on it. They're not going to ask me, you know? So it's like, you know, but it was great to finally be on it. It was a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, you were always going to be asked, for the record. Awesome. So only a matter of when. Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Josh. This was great. Oh, and I guess so. The best way to reach you is probably through your Twitter or through your YouTube page?
Yeah, so you can, I mean, I have DMs open on Twitter. The YouTube page, you can leave comments. There's a Facebook fan page also I have. You can, like, GM Josh Friedel, it's easy enough to search for. And definitely those are the best places to contact me. I used to have a website, which I'm trying to get back up, but for the moment it's still defunct. But between my YouTube page, Facebook, and Twitter, I should be quite reachable. So.
Excellent. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Josh, and good luck in your upcoming tournaments.
Thank you very much.
The new Perpetual Chess theme music is courtesy of Geert Vandervelt. Special shout out to him. I also want to thank everyone who supports the podcast. That includes people who tell their friends about it, people who write positive reviews on Apple Podcasts, and most of all, those who have donated to support the show. I spend about 5 hours a week on each episode, and even though I love doing it, it can be hard to find the time. Without the support of my Patreon and PayPal Perpetual Chess partners, the show would not be possible. They are Adam Ralph, Adam Vrancoulge, Adrian Gutierrez, Andres Krizdwa. I hope I did okay there, Andres, on your name. Alex Pejas, Chris Wainscott, Chad Hilton, Chris Lott, Christopher Wood, Coach J's Chess Academy, Chris Flanagan, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Gary Andrews, Greg Shahadi, James Bonastia, Jason Dunbar, Jennifer Valens, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Johnny McMenamin, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopalakrishnan, Lorraine Dore, Matthew Passy, Macaulay Peterson, Matthew Tedesco, Pascal Charbonneau, Paul Swaney, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, Robert Steiner, Tatya Vabrahamian, Thomas Stonix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotello, Victor Vrankul, Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, everyone. I'll be back next week with another great...
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.